Hello, good evening, and thank you for coming after dinner. I hope you're not all too sleepy. Today, I'm going to talk about emergent democracy. And when you have a chance, the paper is in the proceedings. It's a big, fat, white book, so take a look if you can. Since the paper was written over, I guess, almost over a year ago, we've gone through a lot of different events. And I think in retrospect, the paper was quite optimistic, maybe over-optimistic. I was criticized of being techno-utopian and many things. But the one good thing that the paper did in all of its weakness and problems was that it created a kind of dialogue of criticism and a new kind of thinking that has led to a lot of better papers than my paper being written. And I want to talk a little bit about the process that of how I got to where the paper was, what happened after the paper, and what we can do today. And I'm going to try to end on something kind of concrete, although I'll get somewhat abstract in the middle of the discussion. So I'd like to start out by just talking a little bit about myself. I'm somewhat of a privacy advocate. I'm an entrepreneur and a venture capitalist, and I do kind of policy work and business at the same time. And in September 2001, the Japanese were trying to pass a national ID system. And it was a stupid system. It was part of this kind of vision to use government money to make Japan number one in IT. And the idea was to give everyone a number, give everyone a card. It would make everything much simpler. And it's the kind of obvious problem. So we started a movement to try to stop the national ID system because we believed it was very bad. And in order to get as many people on our cause as possible, we narrowed the point of the discussion to say, let's put a three-year moratorium to stop this bill for 3 years to give us time to talk to privacy experts, to talk to technologists, to try to figure out what the risks are before rolling out this national ID system. And I was quite upset about the Japanese response to that. And at the Davos meeting, the World Economic Forum meeting, I gave a big rant about how bad the Japanese system was. And in July of 2002, this is about, I guess, about a year after we started the movement, they were about to pass the bill and go into this trial. And by the time we had spent a year, I was calling talking to ministers on television, telling them that they were lying, and we rallied, we marched, we did everything we could do as a normal kind of political movement. We had gotten most of the faction heads of the leading party on our side. We had most of the opposition on our side. We had the press on our side. 85% of the people polled didn't even know that this national ID was happening. So for us, we thought, okay, we won. This is everything you can do in a political movement. We had the no visible opponent. We had the politicians on our side. We had the press on our side. We had the people on our side. And then the bill just went through. And so I asked the head of the policy for the ruling party, and I said, why did you pass this bill? This is a democracy. I had everything that I was supposed to do to stop this bill, and I was only asking for a three-year grace period. And I got the far left and the far right. Everyone agreed with me. And he said, oh, it would have caused too much confusion in the system. Okay. So this is when I realized that you can't take democracy for granted, and that in Japan we had a very broken democracy. And the more I dug into it and I studied a little bit about it, we had a dysfunctional judiciary, the political system was broken, it was corrupt, the bureaucrats were in charge. It was just this horrible thing. The more I looked, the worse it got. So I suggested to the people of the World Economic Forum that they let me help organize a session at the Davos meeting about how broken the Japanese system was and why, unless we fix the democracy, we're not going to fix Japan. So it was kind of a almost an anarchist kind of session. And we gave this big rant. And what was interesting, that was in January of 2003. And it was generally well received, but at dinner afterwards, I was sitting next to Sadako Ogata, who is the High Commissioner for Refugees and one of the few international Japanese women. And she said, you know, you're so parochial, Joey. Why are you always talking about Japan? The whole world's democracy is broken. Think about the rest of the world. And so I said, that's a good point. So I refocused my energy a little bit. And this is just when I was starting blogging in 2002. So I was getting excited about blogs. I was investing in a weblog company. And so I think it was, let's see, February of 2003, so the month after this World Economic Forum, I posted an entry on my blog saying, let's talk about democracy and the emergent behavior of blogs. And I had just finished reading Stephen Johnson's great book, Emergence. I don't know if you've read this book, but basically, I'll talk about it later, but the idea was that, you know, systems with many small units like ants exhibit emergent behavior that collectively is much smarter than the sum of the parts. And so my theory was that maybe weblogs as individuals don't seem that smart or that great, but as a collective, maybe they can become smarter than the individual parts. And then I was thinking about democracy because I was thinking about how to fix a democracy and what was wrong with democracy. And I thought maybe if you put together this idea of this broken democracy and can we get some emergent behavior from the blogs, maybe there's something interesting. So a lot of people got together and we had a conference call in an IRC chat and we had a big discussion. And it was quite interesting. It was a little bit over-optimistic, but we realized that things had changed since the web first started. When we first had the first version of Cyber Utopia, we have more tools now. So maybe we can come up with something. And Ross Mayfield, who was on the call, said, well, why don't we call it emergent democracy? So that wasn't my word. I said the emergent behavior of blogs and democracy, and he put it together into this nice phrase. And then what we did is we had a whole bunch of discussions. People sent me a lot of ideas, and then I sort of put them together in kind of a crappy paper that I published on my blog in February of 2003. That was a draft. Then after that, everybody started sending me edits and edits and edits and edits until finally, when we posted the in April, I took the whole paper and put it on the wiki. And instead of saying by Joey Ito, I said mostly by Joey Ito. And I think eventually the paper was started by Joey Ito. But the other thing that was interesting, and it kind of ties in a little bit with Jimmy's discussion yesterday about Wikipedia, once it was on the wiki, the paper was no longer a paper by me or a rant by me. It was never originally anyway because it was a collective idea of all these people, but it became a place and it became kind of a movement. And so we had an IRC channel and the wiki. And then we also had the same problem that Wikipedia has in a funny way, because I would give a talk at Harvard Law School to the constitutional law students about emergent democracy. But I pointed to them at the wiki and every time they looked, it was different. And they said, well, what is this? This isn't the paper, you know? And I said, no, it's a place. And so that was the other kind of interesting aspect of the paper, is that it's, I think, currently on revision 2.3, but it continues to evolve. So anyway, this paper was kind of, and I'll describe the paper a little bit more, but it became kind of a gathering place of people who had a kind of optimistic view of using social technology for changing democracy. And interestingly, that was when Howard Dean was starting to get kind of popular and maybe possibly becoming a presidential candidate. So in April, actually in September of 2003, Howard Dean announced his Internet Initiative and created this network advisory net. And he invited me and a couple of others and many of the people who were involved in this emergent democracy process into this advisory network for Howard Dean. And I can't say how much, if at all, my paper influenced the people who were working on the Dean project, but it definitely had the same kind of vibration, which was about a bottom-up kind of system, which was not under control. And so this kind of series of events was quite interesting. So we decided, okay, let's try to make the Howard Dean campaign an experiment for this emergent democracy behavior and see if it would work. But let me try to summarize the paper a little bit. I guess a couple of the fundamental points that I was trying to make was democracy, and even this Republican representative form of democracy, was designed when the world was a little bit less complex, and when the world was a little less connected, a little slower. You didn't have big multinational corporations that could push governments around, and there was a lot less information. And so if you look at the way that representative democracies like the United States works, you get elected officials who then go around and think and vote and become professionals on issues, and they make decisions for you. But one of the problems is that the issues are becoming so complex, yet the media is becoming so shallow, that it's almost impossible for the elected representatives to make an educated decision. Most of the people, for instance, in most governments, don't actually read the bills that they vote on. And then they can't explain those answers to the people. And there's a very big disconnect in the ability for most of these representative governments to actually represent, one, an intelligent... The reason why you have a representative democracy instead of direct democracy in a lot of places is the assumption is as a professional politician, you have the time and the resources to understand the issues more deeply than the individuals. And the individuals, if you did direct democracy in a large-scale country, would cause some kind of mob rule or populism or some kind of unintelligence. And so you're saying, okay, well, let's give the responsibility of figuring these things out to our representatives. But as we can see, in most representative democracies, we are failing. I don't think anyone thinks that any of the governments we have right now are doing a really good job. And so then we have to look at some of the components of what is democracy. And I won't get into everything because I don't think we have time. But one of the fundamental points about democracy, it's not just about voting, because you're trying to make an intelligent decision. So if you look, for instance, in the American Constitution, it's very important. The First Amendment in the Bill of Rights is the freedom of speech, of press, and peaceable assembly. Now, this freedom of speech is very important because the idea is that unless each person has a voice and unless each person talks to other people and thinks, the voting doesn't matter. You know, Arnold Schwarzenegger was voted by a vote button on the television remote control. There is no deliberation or discussion. And this competition of ideas, this kind of emergence of ideas, this is what is important, this deliberative process, the dialogue, the debate. At the end of the debate, you vote. You can't vote before you have a debate. Now, the problem was that when you say freedom of the press in the United States, it used to be people like Thomas Paine, who used to write these newsletters and crank them out and run around, and you know, he would try to pass his ideas out. And freedom of the press is more, the press, when they talk about that, is more like blogs. It's not about CNN and Time Warner and these things. Those, when we were talking about the press, we were talking about freedom of speech, not the multinational control of what people see. And so, one of the things that's very important is one of the fundamental functions that the press used to serve to provide a voice to the people is gone. What you have in its place is you have, and I'm preaching to the choir, so I probably don't need to stress this too much, but Rebecca McKinnon, who recently left CNN, had a very interesting article. And she said that during the Ted Turner days, they would break the budget if they needed to go after a story. So the journalism was more important at the beginning of CNN than the budget. But now, when she interviewed one of the managers of AOL, they said that, no, CNN is just like any other media asset. It's about the bottom line. Now, when you think about the fact that the news was supposed to be a function of democracy, but now is just an asset, like entertainment, where you're trying to serve people what they want to see, not trying to create a voice to amplify the dialogue and so on and so forth. So we have to recognize that one of the fundamental functions of democracy, the press, is broken. Okay, so we need to address that. And then there are other things that are very important that affect other ways of communication. For instance, when we're talking on the internet right now, we can talk with weblogs, we can talk with email, we can talk on all kinds of things. But if you look at the way that the digital rights management regime is going, and I don't know if you've been following this, but the Grokster case, which is one of the big peer-to-peer cases in the United States, is being taken up by the Supreme Court. Now, this is a very, very bad news, because it can happen two ways. The Supreme Court can say no to P2P, which is terrible for us, because then the DRM guys are going to keep moving forward. Or it can say yes, it's okay to file share. But then what's going to happen is the Congress is going to get so upset, they're going to make another bill that looks like the Induce Act. And I don't know if you know the Induce Act, but the Induce Act says that if you induce somebody, cause somebody to do copyright infringement, then you are liable, you are guilty. And I think everyone knows the DMCA, which is the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. And I think, again, I'm preaching to the choir here, but if you buy a DVD and you bring it home and put it on your Linux box and write some software to play the DVD, that's illegal in America. And the Americans are pushing this law on all the different countries that it has influence over. And so what digital rights management is doing is it's making things that people are doing at this conference more and more illegal. And it's taking the power of innovation away from the technology people and making it more difficult to create tools to allow people to communicate. And this is very important because it may sound, the copyright debate may sound like something that's about content, but it's not. It is fundamentally changing the ability for us to create tools to provide voice and to provide free speech. So I think everybody needs to keep an eye on the digital rights management. Privacy is also another weird thing because I think everyone is very concerned about privacy of themselves. So I don't want people to see that I'm looking at porn, or I don't want people to know that I have a girlfriend or something. But the real danger of privacy is its impact on democracy. What's very dangerous is, so Donatella, who's up next, is going to talk about Arab media. Well, she sent me an SMS today. So does that put me on some list? Should I not eat lunch with Donatella because I don't want to end on a list? Or maybe my children will end on a list. In Japan, there is a newspaper called Akahata. It's a left-wing newspaper. If you ever subscribe to Akahata, you will never get a job in a big Japanese company. If your grandparents subscribe to Akahata, you will never be a public prosecutor in Japan. Now, this is already implemented. Now, imagine if you had all of the tools of profiling, and then you imagine in America where they say, well, if we can catch one terrorist, we don't mind hassling 100,000 foreigners. That's a fair balance. So if you end up being one of the 100,000 people that looks kind of like a terrorist, too bad, okay? Now you think about that, and you think about how does that impact my freedom of speech? And we call this a chilling effect. Okay, I'm not going to talk to Donatella. I'm not going to make the speech because it's going to end up on the internet. And by the way, I'm never going to use the word terror on my blog again, okay? And this really starts to destroy and eat into free speech. And this is the real problem about the privacy issues and about information. And so there's a very good quote, and if I can find it here. So in a democratic society, you want maximum transparency of the government and maximum privacy of the individual. Because without privacy in the individual, you will never have dissent. And without dissent, you will never have change. And if you don't have change, it's not a democracy. And in the pure totalitarian state, the state is completely private, and the individual is completely transparent. Now, you look at the trend that is happening in the United States, there all the laws are to try to protect the government and run into secrecy, and then to make and expose the individual. It's just the trend of every single totalitarian government. And then this is also being followed in many of the other countries. This is a very fundamental thing. It's one way or the other. Privacy for the government is bad, and privacy for individuals is good. And this is fundamental for democracy, and it's very easy to see. But I don't think people are stressing it enough. And the other thing that you need to think of, this is just a very simple kind of physics of power. Anyone who has power doesn't want to give it up. And transparency means you're giving up power. You may gain some trust, but fundamentally you're giving up power. Those people in power in the United States and big multinationals will not on their own give up power and create transparency. It's the people, it's the power, it's the grassroots, it's checks and balances that are required in order to make transparent and diffuse some of the power right now. And the problem right now that we've gotten ourselves in the situation where the big multinational corporations and the big, like the Japanese, this is the worst system in the world. The CIA funded the Liberal Democratic Party to fight against the Russians. And they have been in power almost continuously for 50 years. There is no alternative. Okay, this is what can happen to many countries, and then you just become stagnant. What you need to do is you need to figure out how to pierce into this power and break it apart. And the only way to do it is through transparency, which comes from freedom of speech. And one of the key issues here is also that freedom of speech also doesn't mean, oh, I can say anything I want, but I might go to jail. No, freedom of speech is you can say anything you want without fear of retribution. You have to have the ability to say something and not be afraid. Okay, and this is also very important, and depending on the country, it's very different. Some countries, it means requiring anonymous speech. And I believe very strongly that anonymous speech, even though I get beat up by anonymous speakers all the time, anonymous speech, netted out, is a good thing for the world. And those kinds of things we have to really understand, and if we really believe them and really understand them, we have to protect them. Because there are a lot of stupid people out there who are saying, anonymous speech is what causes fraud. Anonymous speech is destroying commerce. Anonymous speech is helping the terrorists. But it helps the terrorists, but it helps us more. So it's very important to think about protecting anonymous speech, encrypting anonymous speech. A lot of countries, voice over IP is illegal. One of the OSI guys is in jail for using Skype in the Eastern European country. You know, when you're sitting here in the network and lockpicking and we're in America using Skype, we think the whole world is like this. In many countries, voice over IP is illegal. Kenya, they shut down the whole internet to make people stop using voice over IP. Okay, so what most of these countries want is they want the internet to go away, because the internet undermines power. And the other, this is very important, we need to protect the open internet. And I'll talk more about this, but in the next several years, there are going to be some substantial attacks on the self-governing nature of the internet. The governments have realized that when we were talking about cyberspace, so I'm going to go back a little bit, so to the early or the mid-1990s, John Perry Barlow and other people said, okay, we're going to declare independence from the rest of the world. Cyberspace is a sovereign place. It was a different space, a different place. And so when you were online, you were in a different place. No one knew if you were a dog. But what happens is with mobile phones, suddenly the internet is everywhere. It's in the real world. There is no cyberspace or real space. And then there's e-commerce, and there's all kinds of people, normal people starting to use the internet. The internet and cyberspace no longer was a separate space. It became part of the real world. And once it becomes part of the real world, the government start looking and say, hey, wait a second, we need to control this. We need to be careful. Terrorists are using it, and hackers are using it. Aren't hackers bad? And so we are reaching a point right now where there's going to be a substantial attack on the open internet, and we need to be careful about that. So another thing, I've been traveling around for the last couple of years talking to other activists involved in democracy. And if you look at most of these places, for some reason they're extreme. You look at Israel, they're extremely anti-Palestine. You look at Palestine, they're extremely anti-Israel. But I went to Israel and I went and met sort of my kind of middle class guys and girls there, and they were quite normal. You know, they were moderate. They boycotted wine from Gaza and West Bank because they were against the settlements. And actually, one of my friends who has this project called One World, he polls normal people in Palestine and Israel, and he finds that the average person is moderate. Okay, in the United States, you go to most of these normal, middle-class, fairly intelligent people, and they're generally moderate. It's actually quite difficult to be extreme. You have to be kind of stupid, limited in the information that you've been fed, and possibly religious. And so and so if you look at this, it's kind of very fascinating, because I don't know if you guys saw that Bush was the man of the year in Time magazine. It's extremely painful, but I urge you to go and look through this thing, because I mean, it's a piece of crap, but if you get through, like, there's this genealogy of the family tree of George Bush, okay? There isn't a single working class person in that tree for generations, right? Everyone's an investor. They are above the working class. There's, like, I think one person in the U.S. Parliament or the Senate who has a single child at war in Iraq, okay? The people ruling America are not the middle class, but the people voting for George Bush are the lower class. They're the people who don't have time to blog, don't have time to read, are fed mass media communication, are religious. You know, they're the losers, but they're the voters who are voting in the extreme. It's the same in Islam. You get the Al-Qaeda is going after this very low-class people, people who don't have that much future, not the middle class. And if you go in every country, what you realize is the middle class doesn't have a voice. Okay, and we need to save everyone. And I may sound elitist by saying this, but you know, the first step is to take power. So what's happening is you get these guys in power who control the media, who then feed the lower class this bullshit, and get in power. And this is almost true in every country. And then what happens in the UN, you get these representative democracy guys who haven't really thought through the issues. They just have a party line and a message, and it's like billiard ball politics. It's not about deliberation. It's about bouncing and bouncing and taking averages, okay? So we get this horrible system of every country being its worst image. And this is all up because the intellectuals, the people like us, don't have a voice. We're not participant in the discussion. And we have completely no political power. So I think this is consistent in almost every country. I think smaller European countries, actually democracy works. So my theory is that between 3 and 5 million people is the right size for democracy. You get kind of some trust in the government, you get some understanding. This is just my theory, but that's... So those countries about that size, you're off the hook. But the bigger guys, I think, have this strong problem. So if you think about that, I think it's quite important to think about, okay, but if you reach out into Africa and you reach out into all these different countries, the middle class communicates in a different way. They have different means. Even if you're the same middle class, you may have a different amount of money. You may not have a computer. So let me shelf this for a second, and I'll talk about this a little bit later. Let me just march through this paper. There are some also very interesting projects that you should look at. There's a professor named James Fishkin who does this thing called deliberative polling. And what he does is he takes a random sample of sort of people. He's done this in the United States and in Europe successfully. And then he puts them in a room with some experts and makes them discuss and discuss and discuss. And he polls them through this process. And they're just normal, average citizens. And by the end of this two-day session or whatever, they become extremely enlightened. They may still disagree, but they can make an informed decision. And he's done this with difficult questions like Medicare and taxation, things that most people in Republican democracies do not believe that individuals have the capability of understanding, participating, and are making intelligent decisions. It's put in the sort of hands of these professional politicians instead. And so I think that what's interesting is this deliberative democracy is a very costly, intensive process, and you can't do it for everything. But it does show that if you have the right process, maybe you can involve people more in the management and the decision-making in a country than the way it's working now. And I think that's sort of where we were going with this emergent democracy thing was, okay, mass media and messages and complex issues, where are we going to end up? Of course, we're going to end up with something that looks like the American system. But what if we were able to get people to talk about issues? What if we had domain experts? There's some interesting work called liquid democracy, which is you find somebody near you who knows a little bit more than you about a topic, like Volker knows more about European ecology than I do. I give him my vote. He finds somebody else, he can give them his vote. But per issue, you get emergent leadership who has a public debate, and they make decisions. Because the problem is now, we made Republican democracy so that power was no longer hereditary. Well, guess what? Bush's father was a president. You know, you get all these presidents who are sons of presidents and things like that, and most politicians in the United States and America are multi-generational. It's back to the old days of the nobility, okay? So how can we get these complex issues and discuss them among normal people who don't have a whole lot of time and make intelligent decision? And this is where the idea of emergence comes in. And I think this is a geeky crowd, so you won't be as negative as most people. Most people are very negative when I compare them to ants. And yesterday Jimbo compared his guys to Wikipedians to bees. So I'm not the first one. But if you look at, for instance, in Stephen Johnson's book, one ant is not that smart, but it has a very specific program. It knows that if there's a pheromone here and a pheromone there, it does this. If he meets an ant, he does this. And if you look at an ant colony and the exit point of this, the entrance of the colony, they will put, I think, the waste in one place, and they will put the food in another place. And they have some very sophisticated geometry about where they place things in a box, depending on the shape. And they can actually do very complicated math that a single ant couldn't do. And each ant isn't thinking about this, but as a collective action of the ant colony, it can make some very sophisticated decisions and thoughts. It's the same with the bees. As a beehive can make much more intelligent decisions than a single bee. Now, I'm not trying to compare people with ants, but what I'm trying to say is that inside of a complex system, you can still create some kind of intelligence and order that's unexpected if the parameters are right. And I don't know, there's an interesting MIT professor, I don't know if he's still at MIT, his name's William Calvin, and he has a theory about how your brain works, how the surface of your brain works, the cerebral cortex. And his theory is that there's many little columns, they're about half a millimeter size on top in each, and that each sort of bundle of neurons has a bunch of things that it resonates with. So if it hears a song that it likes, it'll amplify the song. And if he hears a song long enough, it starts to become more friendly with the song. And it's much like how people pass music on to each other. But his idea is that when you look at a banana and your impulses come in, some of the cells start singing apple, some sing banana. But eventually, you start recruiting the cells around you. So if five of the cells around you are singing a banana and two are singing apple, you're probably going to say banana. Until finally this kind of democratic system happens on the surface of your brain, and when everyone sings, okay, it's a banana, you go, ah, it's a banana. And this kind of way of, they call it neuronal recruitment, but the idea is that you start singing and trying to influence people around you, and everyone starts singing, and when everybody decides it's the same thing, that's the way the decision is made. And then there's lots of little interesting ways that he tries to describe how creativity and things like that work in that space. But this is also kind of a very interesting kind of emergent system. In a completely different area, Jane Jacob has a book called In the Death and Life of Great American Cities. And she also shows that city planning doesn't really work. You know, you build a project here. I don't know if you have this in Berlin, but you know, just because the city planners decide they want to do this, make this a great area of town, it never works. And what she looks at is, oh, actually, cities with sidewalks have better, less crime. Because the old lady on the corner shouting at the kid and the interaction of the people who are passing each other create areas, pockets of creativity, pockets of order. And it's not about this kind of top-down structured thing. It's a very much a bottom-up thing. And it's about creating this interaction between the pieces, between the ants, that causes some kind of emergent form to happen in the cities. And it's a very interesting book, but again, looking at it from the point of view of city planning. But there are a lot of examples, again, of this where this top-down message created and marching orders idea doesn't work as well as kind of this emergent order. Now, if you look at what makes an emergent system successful, because you can't design an ant, okay? So a lot of people have tried to do this, and there are some computer programs that are kind of work, but they don't really work. It's very difficult to design a system. It has to be kind of trial and error. So there have to be enough positive feedback loops and enough negative feedback loops. So, for example, Stephen Johnson, who wrote Emergence, was very negative about the web when he wrote the book, because this is before blogs, and this is back when in the search engine days. And so when I was running InfoSeek, I knew this very well, which is you make a homepage, and you sit and wait, and no one comes. You try to get it indexed in Yahoo, still no one comes. You make a homepage, no one comes. Okay, and if you are Yahoo or you are InfoSeek or whoever, you get all the traffic. And so what happened was that we thought that just by giving everyone the ability to create a homepage, we would have democracy and egalitarianism and all these wonderful things that didn't happen. Because there wasn't the right feedback mechanisms to drive the traffic to the right places or to filter or to create any kind of intelligence. It was just flat. It was like the old days when they used to spit random numbers into an IBM machine and try to make it intelligent. It doesn't work, okay? And mailing lists don't work because it's the opposite. Everybody's piled into the same place, so you've got the trolls and you've got the crap, and it becomes so noisy and so chaotic and so much information that you stop reading it. And what we're trying to find is somewhere in between. And the way that weblogs, I think a lot of people know what weblogs are, but if you look at the architecture of the way the weblogs were made, and let me back up for 1 second, is before the bubble, there were a lot of wonderful technologies made in layer 2, layer 3, you know, and maybe up to the web was quite interesting. But once people started looking at Amazon and eBay, there was a great bubble. and all the money came flowing in with, together with all the stupidity. And almost all of the brains that could have been working on great projects, not all of them, but most of them, got sucked up into these huge, huge, extremely stupid projects. It was like, okay, we need B2B medical. We have $400 million. Put together 1,000 people and build this thing. When these kids could have been working on open source projects. So this is really kind of a lost decade, not a decade, but a lost period for computers. But when the bubble burst, what was interesting was there were some people that were continuing to work on projects. And the weblog is one of the things that emerged after the bubble burst. And that's why it has the traditional, old-fashioned ethics of the internet. So one of the roadkill disasters of the bubble is Instant Messenger. You know, it's like, why can't we have an open standard for Instant Messenger? Because you have AOL and Time Warner, and then you have the Microsoft guys, everybody making these walled gardens. Well, look at AOL, it's quite interesting. They had 60% or so market share during the peak of the bubble. I think they have 3% now. They have the same number of people. They still act like they have 60% of the market share. But these walled garden people were not from the internet. They were people who wanted customer acquisition, customer retention, blah, 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 blah. The great thing about the weblog people were they were built by people who were disgusted with these walled garden people. They were the people who wanted to connect the internet again. So weblogs have a common API for uploading and editing content. It has several standards, but generally standardized syndication. But one of the most important things is every time you post to a weblog, you ping. You send an XML RPC ping to a server saying, I've uploaded a new message. Please index me. And one of the companies I work for, Technorati, will say, sure. And in about 2 or 3 minutes, your post will be indexed. So if I have a blog, and Volker links to me, and 2 or 3 minutes later, my cell phone in Japan gets an email message saying, this guy just linked to you. This is what he's saying about you. What do you want to do? Click. Look at his page. Oh, fuck you too. Blah, 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 blah. Okay? So... But what's important is it's completely changed. Just that one feature and the trackbacks have completely changed the nature of the discourse on the internet. Because before, if he linked to me, how would I know? Maybe I get some referrals in my logs, but I don't really see it, and other people don't really see it. But now it's like a cocktail party. It's like you're sitting around in a circle with four people talking about something. Somebody walks up, says something. If it's stupid, everyone ignores it. If it's interesting, immediately you're part of the conversation. It's very easy to join a conversation. But it's also very easy to ignore people. And this is what is important. It's hard to ignore people in the mailing list. It's hard to notice people in the old webs. But now with the weblogs, there is some kind of reinforcement and positive feedback. We still have a lot of issues. We're getting comment spam, and there's still a lot of problems. But we're understanding that we have to somehow be inclusive while still being exclusive. And this will create these pockets of intelligence. And what's quite interesting, if you look at the blogs, is that, so there's like a power law of blogs. There's very popular blogs. There are kind of the middle blogs, which are more niche. The power blogs are a little bit more like media blogs. And then most blogs are on this long tail of 4 or 5 people reading the blogs. But what's interesting is if you look, is there's a small number of people who have 4 or 5 friends who are talking about something very specific, like, you know, hacking smart cards, or like the Malaysian bloggers who are talking about Malaysian beaches, right? Suddenly, when there's an earthquake, the Malaysian bloggers, hey, are there any Malaysian bloggers? In a few seconds, we've got them, and they're being amplified across the system. So I always think of these top blogs as, we call it the amplifier, and the tail is kind of like the guitar. And the way that, what's important is that everyone is focusing a little bit too much on these top blogs. This isn't the important part. This is the amplification that we get to sort of punch the media. But the real action is happening in the niche blogs and the smaller blogs where people are constantly keeping thoughts and activities alive. These are the niche people who actually are creating the real information. They're the ones that saw the, are there on the ground who are providing us with the first sources, like for instance with Dan Rather. I think everyone knows this, but he was talking about the letter relating to George Bush on 60 Minutes. 18 minutes after he was on the air with this letter, a blogger said, hey, wait a second, that looks like Microsoft Word. They didn't have Word back then. And it created this whole scandal about this forged documents for Dan Rather, and basically destroyed his reputation, and was one of the reasons, I think, that he resigned recently. But and Dan Rather resigning is actually quite an interesting story, although it was kind of a right-wing blogging thing. It really is a symbol of the loss of authority. And it relates again with Wikipedia, which is, what is authority? You used to never question the anchorman on television. Dan Rather was like the, you know, like the Pope, maybe is different meaning for different people, but he was a guy who didn't question. But now no one is sacred. Everyone is questioned. And the people who question are the people who are part of this large volume of blogs who are talking about very specific things. And then the blogs pick this stuff up and move it up very quickly. Blogs are very good at synchronizing and causing these things to amplify very quickly. On the other hand, they're not very good at sustained focus on a specific topic. And I think wikis are much better at doing that. Wikipedia is doing an excellent job of doing that. And you know, we can talk about, I think there's a workshop later, and we can talk about that some more. But anyway, those are some of the issues that we've been talking about. But in itself, that wasn't enough. And so if you look at the fact that we failed with the Dean campaign, we learned how to raise money better than any other campaign in history, very small amounts of money, $7 or something. We were able to raise millions of dollars. Okay, that was interesting. We got a lot of people involved, which is very new. If you go to the, went to the Dean campaign headquarters at 2 or 3 in the morning, it looked like just like this place. There's like lots of young people, really excited. They're so empowered. And the cool thing about Dean was he didn't force a message. Normally, the way the American politics works is you have a message, you give the message, and everyone carries the message. That's kind of the terminology that they use. What the Dean campaign did is they said, okay, anyone can come to the website and create a constituency. And then you can say what you want. And if what you say is interesting, the Dean campaign will use it. And it was very empowering, and they used meetups and all these different things. So they were able to get a whole bunch of people, at least people who had access to the internet, empowered. But where he failed was when he went to Iowa, the mass media ripped him apart. And I don't know if you know about this scream thing. He made this scream on television. Well, what they don't tell you, even though they reported all once, it was a directional mic that was pointed just at him. So they're screaming all over this hall, but you could only hear his voice. So he was shouting over the crowd, and the AV picked up a really strange-sounding scream from Howard Dean and kept playing it over and over and over again on television. Okay. Now, this is just one of the things that did, but basically what happened was we got all excited about the internet's ability to activate other people on the internet, but when we hit the mass media, the mass media together with the Republicans just obliterated Dean. And in retrospect, I don't know if Dean would have been the right candidate or whether he would have won. But one of the key messages here is that we were unable to cross this barrier from blogs to the mass media. Okay, and this is will lead a little bit to my final sort of section, which is we just had a conference at Harvard, and we had a session called Global Voices. So there were Iraqi bloggers, there was a woman from Kenya, we had the Iranian blogger Hoder, who just had his life threatened. You know, we had Chinese, we had All My News from Korea. In Korea, they've been very successful because their online newspaper elected their president. And so they have their very, you know, yes, we're in charge now. And so it was a really interesting group. But one of the key things that we came away with is every country had a different kind of media form they wanted to use. Somebody wanted to use television, somebody wanted to use wikis, some people wanted to do Blogger Core. And what we realized is that the medium, you have to be able to switch, to go from one step to the next. If you want to cause change, yes, you can get every blogger in the world excited about your movement. But to get beyond blogging to the next phase, you have to be able to switch. And one of the ways that I think about it is I think about it in terms of viral marketing. Okay, this is kind of a stupid metaphor, but it works. So you're a host, okay? You try to get somebody contaminated. But basically the point is try to create an epidemic, okay? So the vector is the medium you're using. So blog, you blog, and you have a infection rate of 3%, okay? So you infect 3% of the bloggers, and they become carriers. They become infected. But these bloggers now, if they're just affecting other bloggers, you very quickly saturate the market. But what you need to be able to do is change the vector. You need to go, okay, this blogger is now going to build a bridge and take this vector, this virus, from the blog scene to the UN white paper scene, or to television, or to satellite. And what's very important is this bridges between the different types of medium, because some people hate blogs, some people hate wikis, some people hate TV, but they consume media in some form. And so one of the key messages I think that we have is, instead of focusing so much on our own community and the way that we do things, is we need to build some bridges, we need to come up with a common goal and try to create this infrastructure for free speech. So we came up with this covenant, and I'm going to just read it because I think it's great. A lot of people, some of the people here worked on this as well. It's still the Global Voices Covenant 0.2. But with all this kind of international group in the room, we were able to kind of agree on this, that we believe in free speech, in protecting the right to speak and the right to listen. We believe in universal access to the tools of speech. To that end, we want to enable everyone who wants to speak to have the means to speak, and everyone who wants to hear that speech, the means to listen to it. Thanks to new tools, speech is no longer to be controlled by those who have the means of publishing distribution or by governments who would restrict thought and communication. Now anyone can wield the power of the press. Everyone can tell their stories to the world. We want to build bridges across gulfs of culture, language that divide people so as to understand each other more fully. We want to work together more efficiently and more powerfully. We believe the power of direct connection, the bond between individuals from worlds, is personal, political, and powerful. We believe conversations across boundaries is essential for the future that is free, fair, prosperous, sustainable for all citizens of the planet. While we continue to work and speak as individuals, we want to identify and promote our shared interests and goals. We pledge to respect, assist, teach, learn from, and listen to one another. We are Global Voices. So this is version 0.2. It's on a wiki. Anyone can come and help edit it, help translate it. But this idea is everybody has their own project. We have Blogger Core, we have Wikimedia, we have you have this CCC. What we're trying to do is create this loose association to create bridges. So this is something that I really like as many of you to participate in as possible. And then just to finally, just on the tactical side, I think that writing tools and providing tools, we just need to keep doing this. We do need to protect the commons, because without, for instance, there is a documentary guy who was trying to do a documentary about Fox and about Bush, and they said, oh no, we're not going to give you the right to use those clips, and it's not fair use. If you try to use it, we'll sue you. Okay, and the minute you can't quote the news anymore, you have a very difficult time criticizing them. And lots and lots of very important books are being forced back into copyright by copyright regimes. So I'm on the board of Creative Commons, and I can go into this in more detail if somebody is interested, but basically the idea is to try to give people the right to publish work that allows the work to be copied more freely or be reused. So please look into Creative Commons and think about copyright. We need to protect the open internet, and I just joined the board of ICANN. A year ago, I would never believe I would be on the board of ICANN, because I thought it would be a terrible thing. But I thought about it, I met a lot of people, and I realized that it's more important to fix ICANN than it is to let it die and have the control of the internet fall into the hands of the governments and other people who are trying very actively right now to take over the control of the internet. So really, I know everyone has issues with ICANN. People have issues also with IETF. But It's the next 2 or 3 years is really the end of this road, okay? If ICANN is unable to become supported by the community and be representative of what we call the internet governance, the only other alternatives are things like the ITU and other things, okay? And then you can imagine what kind of monopolies and politics and difficulty of participation. I think the internet is going to look more like a telephone and a cable network without the ability to innovate. I mean, the internet is great, and you are all here because we're able to innovate without permission, without asking for licenses. The government, the U.S. government, the security people, the monopolies, they all want to force people to be licensed and to require permission to innovate. And this is what it was like before the internet, and this is what will happen if we lose some of these basic internet governance organizations. And with all of its faults, these are the only things we have left. So you can be critical of ICANN, you can be critical of IETF, but I urge you to try to learn about the issues and participate, write papers, write posts, and try to help us fix the problems that you see, rather than just trying to just say it's, you know, not your problem. And finally, I think this free speech thing, I would be very interested in your views, but you know, everyone can disagree, and this is kind of ties into Donatella's talk next. You can't be selective about free speech. You can't say, oh, I want free speech for people as long as they're not terrorists and that they're not right-wing and they look like me. That's not free speech. Free speech means that everyone gets to say what they want. And free speech is also about the ability for people to have a dialogue across these boundaries. It's difficult at the beginning because a lot of free speech sounds like hate speech, and hate speech isn't very constructive. But we need to try to figure out a way to create free speech and create dialogue. And by this, I mean, think about yourself when you listen to Donatella's talk and say, wait, am I being fair? Am I being universally acceptant of free speech? Because if not, they will do the same thing. And they say, well, we don't want to listen to you either. And then you don't have a dialogue, okay? So with that, I'll take some questions if there are any.
Okay, my name is Christian Jacken. Together with a friend of mine, John Donoso alias Syke, we are developing an implementation of liquid democracy. And I would like to know from you, with several endeavors starting to make liquid democracy a reality, which one do you think is the way to make this a reality in politics in the shortest period of time? And taking advantage of this question, I want to suggest that people more interested in liquid democracy, we can do a quick flash meeting here at these stairs here after the questions. Thank you.
So I was told to repeat the questions, and the question was, he's been working on liquid democracy and how can they more quickly make this a reality, I guess. There are a lot of organizations looking into internet governance, electronic. So this is a key point, I think, is this whole stupid e-voting business is causing a lot of problems. And there are a lot of people looking into this. One person I would recommend is there's a woman who's running for Secretary of State in California, and she's very interested in this topic. But to find some politician who's willing to sort of experiment with this and maybe fund it. I'll talk to you later about this, but I think that what we can do is bring together some politicians who are very aware of these issues and just try it in the real world. I mean, I think it's just like most good open source. I think release early, release often, and give it a try rather than, you know, and I think to try to use it in real political issues. We can get it going right away, I think.
I have a tweet comment. You were talking about a tool to, you know, protect freedom of speech or whatever. I don't think we are missing the tool, actually. We are maybe missing the voice. Look at how many empty seats tonight at this room. Last night it was stuff on phishing on Google. It was really full room, you know. So I don't remember who said that, but if you want to avoid revolution, entertain people, you know, make people having fun, then I don't know, it's a question of mobilization, you know. I'm living in Geneva, and it was a G8 last year, and there was a lot of people in the street, you know, young people, you know, protesting. They didn't know why they were protesting, actually, against mobilization, mondialization, against mondialization, something like that. But recently, when in the media, you know, get caught by the FBI, and they shut down like more than 20 websites, no one of those young people in Geneva react to that, you know. And it was really attack against freedom of speech, because today we still don't know why, you know, on the which legal statement do the FBI seize the server in UK at the workspace office, you know. We still don't know. And you were talking about ICANN, but and telling maybe ICANN is better than ITU. I don't know. I don't think ITU is better neither. But ICANN is still Department of Commerce. And today you were talking about the way to make innovation. But all internet is detained by US company. I mean, if you take the chip, you know, it's Intel. If you take the operating system, it's Microsoft, Sun. If you take a router, it's Cisco. If you take information provider like search engine, it's Yahoo, MSN, and Google. You know, so what is the solution? Sorry? I said first I have three comments, you know. So what is the solution then? What do you propose in that way, you know?
So I'll try to be brief.
Just if you can give some information about the World Summit on Information Society.
Yes, okay.
To the room.
So I know this is going to be broadcast later, so I have to be careful about what I say, because I can't say something too negative because it will be political. But first of all, with respect to getting people the tools and getting people excited, I agree with you, but I don't think that, I think it's related. So for instance, the Creative Commons is very important because I'm trying to get African musicians to use Creative Commons licenses so they get attribution instead of getting their music ripped off by Hollywood. And this cultural exchange between countries, and this is part of the voices. When I'm saying voices, I'm not just talking about political speech. I'm talking about music, I'm talking about movies, I'm talking about every kind of cultural exchange. And you have to care about the people to really do anything about it. And that's part of this Global Voices thing, is cultural exchange. And I'll give a very specific example also of there was a young woman who used to read my blog for my silly stuff, my funny stuff. Then she started seeing my political stuff, and she wrote a comment that said, "I never realized research was so interesting." And then she started her own blog, and then she became political. And I watched over the course of a year a person who was quite a passive kind of cultural consumer become a political activist. And so I think that the voices, yes, it's very difficult to wake people up, but I think the tools will help in one way. With respect to ICANN and ITU, I'm going to have to talk about this. This is also a very long discussion, and I think we can talk about it maybe in a side meeting. I mean, WSIS, the World Society, WSIS, and now the WGIG, the Group on Internet Governance, these are all important groups. They are populated by people from civil society who are involved in the UN. It's a very interesting, some interesting stuff they're doing. But one of the problems is that there are people in the ITU who are trying to cause this discussion to become focused on how do we get rid of ICANN rather than on all the larger issues. And so there's a lot of debate about what these groups should be doing. I think they're very important. And I have a lot of friends who are, ICANN just gave $100,000 to WGIG to help them with their effort as well. And so we're trying to work with them. What was your third one? Okay, sorry.
I just wanted to thank you for that lecture. I'm really impressed. I'm a believer now. I'm going to start my blog tomorrow. And I think I'm going to put my ideas to the only test that's worth it, the test of the open source. If it's good enough, only competition with free speech can show if you got good ideas and good concepts.
So I will just give you my final warning, having done this for a couple of years. You will be attacked. Trolls will come, people will call you stupid, utopian, blah, blah, blah. And one of the things you need to learn quickly is to build thick skin, because that's the way you're going to participate in the debate. But welcome to the club.
Hi, I'm Volker, and I would never write fuck you to you, Joey. You started out with the anti-ID campaign in Japan. Looking back from where you stand now in your reflection, what would you do differently now in this campaign? We're working on lobbying the German government on copyright issues. We're sort of at the same position. Yeah. I'd like to get your ideas on that. Thank you.
So I think that everything is much more global than before. So the Council of Europe's cybercrime directive, treaty, or whatever, this is causing crap all over the world. You know, Japan is trying to make really stupid laws, and I had to stamp out these laws, but it's kind of like the commercial about the cockroaches. Once there's 10,000 kids, it's really hard. You have to get them before they make some babies. And so the thing is to keep an eye on these international groups that are making these legislations that become model law for other countries. And so with the ID and all this other stuff, the US is pushing a lot of this agenda, the EU is pushing a lot of the agenda, but what I would have done differently was, instead of trying to attack it in Japan, I would have tried to go to the root of the problem, which is some of the things that the US is saying, some of the issues internationally, work with groups like the Association of Scientists and try to revive the CPSR, get rallies, CCC, but make this a global issue, because Japan is at least very weak to external pressure. And internally, it was unable to make any change. But again, this is why this dialogue is important. As one person, it's difficult to read. Like as my ICANN board, I have to read hundreds of pages before every board meeting, you know, which is every month. It's a lot of work. And so again, I think it's much better to attack this as a community. And because you need to read the white papers. This is like I was talking about the vectors. You can't just write on the blog. At the end of the day, you have to submit a white paper and you have to write letters to legislatures, and it's a lot of work, a lot of action. And so you do need to create communities that do things. But I guess the point I was trying to make was, I think it's important to get it global before the stupid idea becomes a treaty.